and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the second devaluation of the Chinese currency in 2 days and speak with an expert on the politics of Chinese banking policies. Victor Shi, a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program at the University of California, San Diego, joins us. We will examine the extent to which China is involved in currency manipulation, as U.S. politicians charge, or whether this is a blow to China because the renminbi was seen as one of the most stable emerging market currencies, and it remains to be seen whether there will be more devaluations and whether the Central Bank of China can adapt to a new system of determining exchange rates. Then we'll speak with Marion Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health and a Professor of Sociology at New York University, about a New York Times investigation into how Coca-Cola hired researchers to find that the obesity epidemic in America is not caused by too much sugar in the diet, but rather by lack of exercise. We'll discuss her new book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning, and her article in the UK Guardian, Coca-Cola Says Its Drinks Don't Cause Obesity, Science Says Otherwise. Then finally, we'll look into reports that the young North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has executed a vice premier because he had expressed discomfort over Kim's forestation policy. Sumi Terry, the former National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us to examine this latest of 70 senior officials killed under Kim Jong-un's rule following the recent execution of a defense minister who was blown to bits by anti-aircraft fire. And joining us now is Victor Shi, a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He has been published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. He is currently engaged in a study of how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographical information of the elite in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Shi.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And China's decision to devalue its currency, the renminbi, by 2% against the dollar on Tuesday is largely, I think, seen here in the United States as currency manipulation to increase China's exports at the expense of other markets. But what's your sense? I take it that you think that there's much more significance to this.
I don't think what China did is, you know, any more manipulating the currency than what many other countries have done in the past couple of years. The Japanese yen has depreciated vis-a-vis the dollar by something like 40%. The euro has declined by 30%. And so, China devaluing the currency is partly out of self-protection because alongside the dollar, the renminbi has appreciated tremendously vis-a-vis the euro. And also the yen, which has really hurt China's export. But what's really interesting about this episode is that, the Chinese currency had been seen as the most stable risk asset in the emerging markets, with very little movement, just 0.5% or sometimes, most of the time, 0.25% movement every day. With this 2% one-day movement, the volatility of the renminbi has increased tremendously. And I think some of the less safe and more volatile risk assets, such as the ruble and other emerging market currencies, may be moving even more volatile in a more volatile manner now that the renminbi seems to be depegging from the U.S. dollar.
But a lot of analysts are suggesting that the renminbi may just be the beginning of a long-term slide in its exchange rate.
I think it is quite possible, but the People's Bank of China, China's central bank, is going to have to play a very fine-tuned balancing game. On the one hand, of course, a depreciation of the currency is going to help export and help the Chinese leadership reach its 7% growth target. But on the other hand, onshore investors and money, of course, in China is concentrated in the hands of a small number of people. If they see the currency declining without end, it's going to motivate them to move their assets overseas, which may cause a capital flight that's beyond the control of China's government.
Well, China's exports tumbled 8.3% in July, apparently because of weaker demand in Europe and the US and Japan. And of course, China's economic problems also hurt the Australian dollar and the New Zealand dollar. I take it, I don't know about the Brazilians, but the theory being that Australia and Brazil are countries that depend so much upon exporting raw materials to China. So give us a sense of the ripple effect here.
To be sure, I mean, with the depreciation of the renminbi, China's ability to purchase raw material from Australia, Brazil, South Africa is going to diminish on the margin, and that is going to cause problems for those countries in terms of the balance of trade. And of course, the currencies of those countries, as I was saying, had been already a lot more volatile than the renminbi. And so with China's own currency becoming more volatile, we're going to see a lot more volatility for those currencies. Part of what China tried to do last night was to anticipate the volatility that would have come anyway once the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. Part of what they may have tried to do is to basically see some of this volatility ahead of Federal Reserve's potential rate hike in September or in December. We'll see if this is in retrospect, later on, we can see if this turns out to be a wise strategy. But it certainly introduces a lot more uncertainty into the currency than had been the case before yesterday.
And again, I'm speaking with Victor Shi, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He has published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. He is currently engaged in a study on how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographical information of elites in China. So when you mentioned the Chinese official target of a 7% growth rate, even if they hit that target, it'll be a 25-year low.
Yes, indeed. It's going to be among some of the lowest growth rates in China. But for someone, for a country at China's GDP per capita level, approaching a middle-income country, that is still quite a high rate of growth. And one thing I do have to say is that the Chinese leadership is still very much stuck in this planned economy mode where they obsess about achieving growth targets. This devaluation may be yet another attempt by the leadership on top of various stimulus measures that the government has already rolled out already to achieve the growth target. I think for other objectives for the Chinese government, like reform, like introducing market forces, such an obsession with growth target can be a detriment.
So what do you think then is the likely response? You mentioned earlier that this may be actually a clever anticipation of the Fed finally raising interest rates. There's been a pretty clear signal that that may happen. How would you rate this peculiar relationship that the U.S. and the Chinese have in their kind of interlocked economy? There was a lot of reports recently that China was dumping treasuries, which didn't really pan out as far as I could do from looking into it. So there's a clear compact here, isn't there?
I think this move, in retrospect, may turn out to be a mistake. One factor that most investors do not realize is that China's external debt is actually quite high. If you were to count the dollar borrowing by Chinese firms offshore in Hong Kong, China's external debt is approaching $2 trillion. And with this depreciation, and the reason why the debt is so high, you say, well, how is that possible? China runs a trade surplus. Why does it need to borrow dollars? And the reason is because for a very long time, there was an interest rate disparity between dollars and renminbi. So clever speculators would borrow U.S. dollars at very cheap rates in Hong Kong and then move the money into China to take advantage of relatively higher interest rates. And this carry trade was highly profitable because also the renminbi was a rising currency. And now with the renminbi beginning to decline and maybe sliding even more in the future, I think there is a risk that this carry trade, the carry trade could be somewhere between $800 billion to $1 trillion. That could unwind very rapidly, thus taking a lot of foreign exchange from the reserve offshore back to offshore locations. And that could be quite a shock. I'm not sure, whether the Chinese government had considered this possibility, but that certainly is a risk. And the risk of unwind was already present because of the possibility of Federal Reserve rate hike, which would have made the carry trade less profitable in the near future in any event.
But if you add this speculation that you're talking about in terms of being able to get dollars cheap and make a profit in China with them, that speculation, if that's ending, and combined with the fact that the bubbles burst on the recent overheated speculation on the stock market in China, is this a controlled kind of bursting of the bubble or is it uncontrolled?
I'm sure the government would like to control, this entire process. And I would say the domestic stock market, they have the ability to control it, as they have shown with recent actions. But I'm afraid the global currency market is something that's beyond the control of the Chinese government. And so this move, may have been a trigger for, for something much bigger, for a lot more volatility, both on the currency front and also on domestic assets. Because, of course, you're right that if there is a large amount of money flowing out of China, the prices of domestic assets would also face downward pressure, including the property market and the stock market.
But there have been reports to that effect. Have you noticed any major outflow of capital?
Well, there has always been sizable outflows. If you look at the balance of payment numbers, sizable outflows on the capital account for the past, 2 years or so. But because of the carry trade, there was always sort of some inflows to counteract the outflows. And in addition, China still runs a sizable trade surplus, although part of that is just hot money inflows. Basically, people use fake export invoices to sneak money back into China through legal channels. But what's interesting is that China stopped publishing the balance of payment gross flows. I mean, they still report the net flows to the public, but they stopped reporting the gross flows, possibly because the numbers just look too scary. But last we have seen, last year in 2014 in China, there was, something like $5 trillion of gross inflows and $5 trillion of gross outflows. Of course, the inflows are still slightly larger than the outflows. So people see the net increase of a couple hundred billion dollars, and they conclude that everything is fine in China. But in reality, because of the trillions of dollars of gross flows into and out of China, even a 10 or 20% change in the direction of the flows can lead to trillions of dollars flowing out of China. And that's, I think for both the leadership and for the market, that's one of the worst scenarios that can play out.
But since you're constructing a large database on biographical information of the elites in China, there have been persistent stories of the elites parking their money, not to mention their children in universities and abroad, particularly in Australia and in Vancouver and here in the United States. Is there anything to that? Because that would indicate if the children of the elite and the profits of the elite or their ill-gotten gains or otherwise gotten gains, right. If they're getting them out of the country, that would indicate a lack of confidence in the Chinese economy.
Well, of course, Southern California is one of the favorite destinations of wealthy Chinese elite. My sense is that this sort of government corruption money flowing to Southern California has actually slowed down because of anti-corruption. What really matters in terms of the overall picture is that the tens of thousands, maybe close to a million, very wealthy entrepreneurs who have made lots of money, you know, these are high net worth households worth $50 million or more per person. By and large, they had still preferred to invest within China or in the near abroad, such as in Hong Kong. But with the latest episode and with also the interest rates disparity between dollar and renminbi narrowing, if their preference were to change so that they really begin to aggressively diversify out of Greater China into further abroad, such as the United States and Australia, then we could see hundreds of billions and maybe even $1 trillion dollars in outflows out of China. This process is ongoing, but I think you know, the devaluation yesterday certainly will speed up this process.
So what then is the other dimensions to this story about the brother of the former top aide to Hu Jintao, the former Chinese leader, who supposedly has lots of secrets and the Chinese government wants him, and he's hiding somewhere here in the United States where he has a property up in Northern California?
I don't know what other dimensions. I mean, it's part of it is, you know, this negotiation between the United States and China, you know, about the status of this person. I'm not sure if this person is helping the U.S. government in any way or not. But if he is, then the U.S. would be reluctant to return him to China. Of course, China is trying to crouch this in terms of corruption, that, you know, countries should cooperate with each other to catch criminals, you know, internationally. I'm not sure if the U.S. viewed this in the same light. I mean, I'm sure this person has broken multiple laws in China and probably, you know, is not the cleanest person in any system. However, you know, he could be providing some information to the U.S. that's valuable to the U.S. That's something I think that the U.S. and China will have to, you know, negotiate going forward.
Well, earlier, just in closing, I was trying to get a sense of this strange kind of economic ties that the U.S. and China has at the same time with competition and friction. So there's a sort of, I don't know, for the want of a better word, a kind of love-hate relationship going on. They're entwined, but they're not lovers, if you to put right. it bluntly. But there's equally on the security front a similar condition going on where it appears that the U.S. and China are engaged in a kind of cold war in cyberspace. And we just learned that at least the U.S. has charged that Chinese hackers have hacked into the accounts of the head of the NASDAQ, you know, the stock exchange. So, and we know that the earlier charges that enormous data from the government, who essentially had all the resumes of every government employee, including all of their background and all the information you'd ever want on somebody. And of course, these people include all of the spies that the U.S. has. So that was considered a pretty extraordinary breach. And of course, arguably, it's the fault of the U.S. for using these contractors who they get cheap. Well, they don't get them cheap. They cost a lot of money, but they hire cheap labor. And they didn't secure this data very well. But that, you know, whether we go after our own sloppy contracting and outsourcing, which I think is a problem in itself, we seem to want to blame China for everything. So how would you rate this cold war in cyberspace?
So I think, so the same kind of, you know, whether it's a real conspiracy or, you know, a perceived conspiracy happens on the financial front also. On the part of China, I really think there is a real effort to try to sell what essentially is waste paper. You know, I would call it, you know, bonds that are completely worthless to the rest of the world. So the rest of the world would underwrite the enormous debt problems that China has. You know, as we talked about last time I was on the show, China's debt to GDP ratio, you know, by debt, I mean not just government debt, but also firm and household debt, is something like 250% of GDP. A lot of firms are defunct, yet they still issue a lot of bonds into the bond market. And frankly, the domestic bond market is exhausted. You know, the People's Bank of China, the central bank, now is in a position to print more and more money in order to roll over this debt. China would love to make the renminbi a global reserve currency so that pension funds and central banks around the world begin to buy this debt that's issued in renminbi by Chinese entities. This is part of the reason why the latest, you know, reform of the foreign exchange system, which they also rolled out last night, tried to appease the IMF. So the IMF really complained about the way that the Chinese central bank set the exchange rate. They reformed that in accordance to what the IMF would like. Of course, some people in China now has a conspiracy theory that, well, the IMF is trying to get the People's Bank of and their allies and the People's Bank of China is setting a trap for the Chinese government. Once, you know, the renminbi is liberalized some more, once there's more inflows and outflows, then there's going to be a speculative attack on the renminbi and the entire economy is going to collapse. This is all Western plot. So on both sides, you know, there are people on both sides who are pointing fingers at each other, you know, thinking that there is this financial warfare going on between two countries. The reality is somewhere in between. You know, I do think that there are people within People's Bank of China who have personal agenda more for personal glory than for, you know, anything else or any kind of plot, who would like the renminbi to join the SDR. Of course, that's, you know, China joining the SDR is going to allow the Chinese government and also Chinese firms to issue more bonds to foreigners, to foreign investors. But the impact is, you know, going to be, it's not going to be a sudden one. It's going to be a very gradual one. And are there people in the IMF or another Western government who would like to see at least a small financial crisis in China? Perhaps that is the case. But you know, of course, China is not stupid. They're not going to walk into something that's immediately going to lead to a financial crisis. So I would say, yeah, there is some tension in the financial arena, but maybe in the world of finance, people first and foremost, of course, they like to make money. So that's sort of an equalizer on that front. So there is still some a lot of cooperation, I would say, between the various governments through multinational agencies like the IMF.
Well, Victor Shi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Shi, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He has published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. He is currently engaged in a study of how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographical information of the elites in China. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Coca-Cola's phony research into what's causing the obesity epidemic in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marion Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health, and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and Managing Editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health, and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Science Board. She's also the author of Eat, Drink and Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influenced Nutrition and Health. And her latest book out in October is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marion Nessel.
Glad to be here.
And the New York Times ran a big front page story telling us, and I know you've also have the article in the UK Guardian, that Coca-Cola is making a concerted effort essentially to distract us all from what the real culprit is in obesity, at least in conversations I've had in the past with researchers like Robert Lustig at the University of California, San Francisco, an expert on childhood obesity. The connections are pretty clear, and some people in the research community have gone so far as to say that sugar is a toxin, but no mention of it. It's all exercise, exercise, exercise. Is that where we stand?
Well, I think it certainly is. Sales of full sugar sodas are way down in the United States, and so are sales of diet drinks. So the soda companies are pretty desperate to try to do something about health advocacy to consume less soda, which seems to be really effective. And in fact, the soda companies think that obesity is the single greatest threat to their profits because of all the advocacy around drinking less soda. So among the many, many other things they do to try to protect their sales is to fund research and researchers.
Right, but isn't the problem the product that they're peddling?
Well, that's certainly a product. That's one of the problems and one of the reasons for the advocacy. Sugar-sweetened beverages are sugars and water and nothing else. They have no redeeming nutritional value. So in that sense, they're low-hanging fruit for public health advocates. It's the first thing you stop if you're trying to lose weight.
So, but as a company, as a responsible corporate citizen, is there anything they could do to cut the sugar in their drink, which apparently is not what they're doing?
Well, they can't because they've planned those drinks. They can't make any changes to the formula of the drinks without causing an enormous number of their core customers to complain. And there's plenty of evidence for that, for times that they tried to do that. So they can't shave the sugar off. What they can do is try to make lots and lots and lots of beverages that don't have as much sugar, and that they're doing.
But is that to say then, Marion Nessel, that essentially the problem is we have a lot of Americans who are addicted to sugar?
Well, I don't know about the addiction, but we certainly like the way sugar tastes. It's delicious, and people like it, and people like it in very, very large quantities. Although I think most people don't have any idea how much sugar is in a soda. That's a big surprise to a lot of people. 10 teaspoons in one 12-ounce can is really more than anybody would put into a glass of water if they were making it themselves. But in focus group testing, when they test people's reactions to different formulas, people like the really sweet drinks. So that puts the soda companies in a really difficult position. And right now, the latest Gallup poll says that 60% of Americans are trying to avoid sodas. That's tough if your business is making sugar water.
And does that also, that figure, translate to people on food stamps? Because one of the statistics that I'd heard is that a lot of families on food stamps, particularly single mothers with having to feed a number of children, have to stretch their food budget pretty thin, and they tend to rely on starchy foods and sweet sodas because that gives you the illusion that you've eaten something.
Oh, and people like sweet foods. And one of the big political arguments these days is whether taxpayer-supported food stamps should be allowed to be used for things like sugar-sweetened beverages. And lots of people think they shouldn't be, and it's a big issue. So it's, we have a system in this country where some foods are cheaper than others. I mean, if you think about soft drinks, they're using tap water as the base. It comes out of the tap, it's practically free, and then they throw in some sugar and some flavors, and they can sell the drinks at very, very high profits. So even though the companies are making other kinds of drinks, those other drinks aren't nearly as profitable as the sugary ones. It's a big problem for the companies.
And again, I'm speaking with Marion Nestle, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and Managing Editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health, and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Science Board. And she's the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. And her latest book out in October is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And she also has an article at the UK Guardian. Coca-Cola says its drinks don't cause obesity. Science says otherwise. So in terms of the title of your article, Marion Nestle, it sort of raises to me the problem that we have just as a society in general, where the truth is a moving target and reason and rationality is often overwhelmed by faith-based ideas. So when you basically tell the world and tell Coca-Cola that they've got it wrong, that the problem is sugar and that exercise is not going to solve the problem, what kind of sense do you have of who's listening? In other words, are the people that already understand science, they don't need to be told. It seems like the people who consume soda need to be told. But what's your sense on whether they're listening?
Well, I think the article on which all of this is based was this investigative report by the New York Times on Coca-Cola's funding of nutrition scientists. So it very much depends on which scientists you're talking about. And there hasn't been nearly the kind of scrutiny given to industry-funded studies in the food and nutrition area as I think there should be, and as there has been for tobacco and these days drug studies. I think the issues are exactly the same. If a food company sponsors a research study, it's because it wants to use the results of that study in marketing. And that they're able to find investigators who are willing to do those kinds of studies, and because the journals require investigators to disclose who the funder is, these things are now being revealed. I've been writing about this kind of thing on my blog, foodpolitics.com, for years now, but I don't have nearly the reach that the New York Times does. So I think it's terrific that this is being brought to public attention.
And, of course, the analogies with big tobacco are pretty clear, aren't they? I mean, I think
they're very clear. I mean, food isn't tobacco, of course, and nobody is saying that it is. But the marketing issues and the way in which the soda companies in particular are using the tobacco industry playbook in order to distract attention from the harm caused by their products is very, very similar. And I think needs the same kind of policy approaches to get it to stop.
Well, but in terms of the methodology of hiring, for the want of a more polite term, academic whores,
That's your term, not mine.
I just said that. I made that clear. That's my term. That I don't know whether you recall the movie that sort of about what undid Big Tobacco, which is about the whistleblower on the inside.
Yes, The Insider. I've seen it.
Yes, exactly. So do you think somebody might come forward from inside the sugary beverage cabal, if that's the right way to describe them?
Well, they actually have. There have been a couple of former marketing executives of Coca-Cola who have gone over to the health side and talk about the karmic debt that they owe for the way they used to market products to children. And they're very clear about what the companies do to try to market their products to vulnerable populations like kids and low-income people and minorities and so forth. So I don't know whether you need a whistleblower. I mean, what the New York Times reporter did was to use the Freedom of Information Act to request information about how much money Coca-Cola was paying these investigators, and it ran into the millions. And, of course, the scandal about this particular incident was that the website that these investigators were using to promote physical activity as the solution to obesity was paid for by Coca-Cola, and it wasn't disclosed originally. So one of the things you want to insist is that these relationships are disclosed. They aren't always.
Well, I get a lot of solicitations to interview people from various political interest groups, and most of the stuff that you get on a daily basis comes from conservative groups because, frankly, they're more well-funded and better organized than the progressive and liberal ones tend to be. And I've been getting blizzards of stuff about this terrible intervention against Coca-Cola and the slanders from the New York Times. And the essential drift of what the conservatives are arguing is that this is nanny state politics. So what's your answer to that?
Well, that's part of the playbook. The playbook is, number one, discredit the science. Number two, discredit the critics. Number three is invoke nanny state. And then you sue and go to court. That's the next step. So those are all part of the playbook. And anytime you hear a food company invoke nanny state, you know that their bottom line is what's really at stake.
But you've told us, Marion Nestle, that their bottom line has already been affected. So surely for them, the writing's on the wall. I mean, what is their strategy? Denial?
Well, their strategy is, first of all, to make products that maybe will take off and sell as well as their full sugary drinks are. Right now, the big product that's keeping Coca-Cola afloat is the little 8-ounce can. Those are selling with the names on them. Those are selling very, very well. And for as long as that continues, that'll be terrific. And it's a small portion. So from a health standpoint, it's good all the way around. But if the sales fail, you know, it's not enough that these companies have to make a profit. They have to grow their profit every 90 days and report growth to Wall Street. And that's really the problem that they're under. I mean, they could just keep selling products and making lots and lots of money, which they do, if they didn't have Wall Street to contend with and their stockholders who expect higher and higher returns on investment year after year. So these companies are under terrible pressure, and they fight back in every way they can. And I'd like to see some of those press releases. They aren't sending them to me.
Well, but, you know, it seems to me that in our popular culture, particularly in these TV reality shows like The Biggest Loser, where overweight people are sort of punished in a sadistic way to lose weight, the general drift of that, and I guess of what Coca-Cola is trying to spread through the people that it's hired to emphasize exercise over the fact that what the sugar in the very drinks that they're peddling as what the problem is that it's the blame the victim syndrome, isn't it?
Well, wouldn't you, if you were a soda company, wouldn't you rather blame the victim than take responsibility for what you're doing and what you're selling? I can understand that.
Right.
It is blame the victim. Personal responsibility is part, blaming personal responsibility is part of the playbook. And they don't talk about the amount of advertising that they put into, the amount of money that they put into advertising their products, the amount of money that they put into lobbying behind the scenes. In my book, Soda Politics, I counted up the number of lobbyists that Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and the American Beverage Association have in Washington, and it was 76 people who were working for them, lobbying people on the Hill to make sure that no legislator passes any kind of law or regulation that's going to hurt their bottom line further. And so they're doing that. They've been doing that for a long time. And now they have to fight the New York Times on this. They will do that in every way they possibly can. I think they're losing the war. And the reason why my book has parenthetically and winning is because they think health advocacy is what's making their lives miserable, and I do too.
But isn't that pretty strange, the idea that as America gets healthier, they get more desperate and more indignant?
Well, it's understandable. It's highly ironic. This is a company that has been around for 100 years, is universally respected, admired. It's in every country in the world. There isn't a single country in the world that doesn't have Coca-Cola. And it spends billions to introduce its products into markets that haven't had them before. I mean, it's promised that over the next 5 years, it's going to put $5 to $10 billion each in India, China, and Africa.
Well,
so great. Those countries can have the same levels of obesity that we do.
And diabetes, which is...
And diabetes, which follows from the obesity.
Right. Well, that's what Big Tobacco did. They moved into China and India in a big way after...
Well, yeah, as I keep saying, the soda industry is following the tobacco industry playbook.
Right.
They've learned a lot from the tobacco industry.
But when you said a little while ago that the average can of Coca-Cola has what? Did you say 12 teaspoons or tablespoons of sugar?
No, a 12-ounce. There's five teaspoons of sugar in every 6 ounces. So for a 12-ounce soda, there are 10 teaspoons of sugar.
And the little cans that are now becoming more
popular. Yeah, they only have 7 teaspoons.
Oh, I see.
Or 6.5 or something like that.
Right. Well, that doesn't sound like anything to celebrate.
No, I mean, but it's less. But it's that's what seems to be selling. And how long they can keep that up, I don't know. Once you have a couple of cans of Coca-Cola with your name on them, how many more do you want?
Right, but you know, when I get gas at gas stations, and you line up behind people that are making these fast food purchases, and they have these big plastic containers, they're almost a gallon in size, full of sugary drinks. I mean, it seems...
Yes, one of my colleagues has just sent me a photograph from a gas station in Arizona in which you could refill your soda supply with 100 ounces for $1.50. She thought it was worth a photograph. I was really happy to see it.
I know, but that is, you know...
That's staggering.
It is staggering. That's a diabetic attack, it would seem, in the making. Well, I guess the fight goes on, right? You think that eventually, and that's why you have at the end of the title of your new book that'll be out in October, Soda Politics Taking on Big Soda, and winning, the "and winning" part is something that we can be grateful for. But what should our listeners do in the meantime? They obviously can't rest on their laurels and expect things to...
Oh, no. I mean, it's a question of voting with your fork and not buying sodas. But it's also getting involved in the political process and trying to elect officials who are going to be more concerned about public health than corporate health. This is a long, long-term effort, especially with the kind of government that we have right now. But I think people who are concerned about these issues can get involved in politics at the local level and start doing things at the local level that will have an enormous effect nationally. I see this. I live in New York City, and I saw this when Mayor Bloomberg was initiating all of these public health measures to try to help New Yorkers to be healthier, and many of them have gone national.
Well, Marion Nestle, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Marion Nestle, who's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and Managing Editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health, and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Science Board. She's also the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, and Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, and her latest book out in October is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And she also has an article at the UK Guardian, Coca-Cola says its drinks don't cause obesity, science says otherwise. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest killing spree tantrum by North Korea's young dictator. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you make of this report out of South Korea that a Vice Premier, Cho Yong-gon, was killed in May on orders from Kim Jong-un, and he hasn't been seen in public since December? So, you know, we hear these things, and usually they end up being right, but how do you verify these claims?
Well, it's really very difficult to verify such reporting, any reporting on North Korea, just because we lack information when it comes to North Korea. But I would not be surprised if this is the case. The reason is because Kim Jong-un has been reshuffling the elites. He has purged some 70 senior elites since he came into power. If you remember, he just recently, a couple months ago, executed his former defense minister, Hyun Young-chul, for apparently his lack of respect and for insubordination because he fell asleep while Kim Jong-un was speaking. And we're now on to about seventh defense minister now, I believe. So I'm not surprised at all if this turns out to be true.
Well, this particular North Korean defense minister that you just mentioned, he was executed by anti-aircraft fire. Blown to pieces.
He was blown to bits, I believe.
Right. Well, that's a pretty graphic thing. I mean, how would that be reported? I mean, we saw the footage of his uncle being essentially condemned to death at a big public or a sort of parliamentary meeting, for the want of a better description. Was there any record of the of blowing apart the defense minister on the firing range with anti-aircraft fire?
Well, I believe that U.S. imagery did pick up images of North Korea using anti-aircraft gun towards people. It's hard to confirm that it was this particular defense minister. I don't think we had footage of that, but there are imagery of North Korea using such execution style for against people. So we just, you know, it's not 100% confirmation that this man was killed in this manner, but we have proof that North Korea has used this execution style against folks.
And the fact that this vice premier, I believe there's what, is there seven vice premiers in the structure?
This, how many that has been replaced?
Well, how is the structure? He's effectively a cabinet minister, right? But he's also
right. There are like seven or eight cabinet ministers.
Right, and he was apparently, according to the South Korean intelligence agencies who are reporting on this through the Yonhap news agency, apparently he criticized Kim Jong-un, expressed discomfort against the young leader's forestation policy. That's all we know?
That's all we know. Again, it's hard to verify if that's true or not, but I would not be surprised if that is the case, because what we know about Kim Jong-un thus far is that he is someone that you just can't tell, that you disagree with him. And this is what truly concerns me about his leadership style and decision-making. In North Korea, we already have, you know, one of the world's most rigidly hierarchical decision-making system, right? We have a unitary political system or imperial presidency. The man on the top is a state, Kim Jong-un at the moment. And in this system right now, there's no institution or a person who can effectively challenge Kim Jong-un or question any of his decision-making. So this is very, very troublesome and concerning from our perspective, of course.
So what is the issue with forestation? My understanding is that the country's in a severe drought and one-third of the rice paddies have dried up. But Kim Jong-un apparently wants to plant a lot of trees, and I'm not sure what this vice minister, what his alternative suggestion was that got him killed. Do you have any idea of that?
I am not sure what he has suggested, but what we know is that Kim Jong-un has extremely unrealistic requests. So So, for example, he would say, make our airport, Pyongyang airport, a standard, you know, state-of-the-art, beautiful airport. And apparently, you know, in constructing, in rebuilding the airport, if it doesn't go exactly the way he wants it done, he will blame whoever is in charge. So he is very immature person who sort of says, I want the way, you know, things to go this particular way. And it's very, very unrealistic. And if anyone were to challenge that, they are in trouble. And it's not only whether it's, you know, forestry or building airports or ski resorts and so on. He's just an extremely difficult person to deal with.
So you're describing a spoiled brat.
I'm afraid, you know, that's what he has displayed so far. And as I said, you know, it's very troubling, particularly when it comes to decision-making, because what we are looking at then from the U.S. perspective is just a lot of up-and-down improvisation coming from him, a lot of immaturity, and very rash decision-making. And again, then there's no one in North Korea who can challenge Kim Jong-un. Because he has tendency to overreact. As you mentioned earlier, he killed his own uncle, number two most powerful man in North Korea, in an extreme public manner. And his father, Kim Jong-il, or his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, have never done that. So even in a country like North Korea, the way Kim Jong-un is acting is extremely, it's unprecedented.
And again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So I guess the first speculation would be, and I know, you know, it sort of reminds me of the old days of the Soviet Union, and, you know, trying to read the Kremlin tea leaves. It became a kind of an art or a science, but a rather inexact one. So trying to figure out the motives of this young dictator in North Korea is probably somewhat futile. But I guess in terms of cheap psychiatrics, you would probably diagnose him as being insecure.
Deeply insecure and extremely spoiled and very immature, I would say. But I agree with you. You know, I've been following the North Korean issue, particularly from, you know, CIA, looking at every available intelligence for over a decade. And I can tell you one of the most difficult things to understand is regime intentions and leadership intentions. And so And North Korea is one of the most difficult country to understand in the world. That's why we call it a hard target. And so, again, trying to understand what is exactly in this young man's mindset is really very difficult for us to figure out.
But since it's so hierarchical, you can make the assumption that nothing happens there without his permission. Would that be the reasonable?
Yes, I would say that's a correct assumption right now.
Right. So when the North Koreans deliberately placed landmines in the DMZ, and South Korean, they snuck in and put landmines in, and South Korean soldiers were blown up and badly injured, would that order have come from him?
Absolutely, it would have come from him. There's no way North Korea could have done something like that without his specific order.
So what's he trying to do there?
He's trying to cause, it's going back to some sort of provocation to get attention and to get dialogue going, because it's been kind of slow a couple months. So the guy who actually ordered this is a person who was in charge of other incidents. The guy named Kim Young-chul, he was behind other acts in the past. For example, like the Cheonan sinking in 2010, where North Koreans sunk a South Korean vessel. Yeomphyeong Island shelling again in 2010. So this guy is in charge of coming up with various provocative acts against South Korea. And again, he was in charge of this act, apparently.
Well, his policy specifically on planting trees and reforestation, apparently he made a speech in February where Kim Jong-un said, quoting, "At present, the forests of the country can be said to have reached a crossroads, whether to perish forever or to be restored." So What? I mean, surely we have overheads to see what the state of the place is. If a third of the rice paddies have dried up, what is the situation? Have the forest been cleared? I mean, I understand people forage for food. What's happening there in terms of both the destruction to the environment and whatever efforts Kim Jong-un is trying to make that got this poor guy executed?
Well, there was severe drought in North Korea, so there was a deforestation. And what, again, the issue is his unrealistic expectation that things can change overnight. So he would give out these orders to his underlings, and they have to deliver. So if the country does not change fast enough to his liking, or things don't go the way he wants it, he blames his people for not being able to deliver what he wanted. So, yes, there is a problem in North Korea when it comes to forestation, but it's not something that this guy can control necessarily. But it doesn't matter to Kim Jong-un. You have to deliver, whatever he wants. Again, that's what I'm talking when I say it's extremely immature, it's not thought out, and very unrealistic expectations.
But that's got to drive everybody down the chain of command crazy, right? I mean, is it so tightly controlled that there are no adults in the room that can get together and say, we got to stop this because this guy's crazy? And, how can anybody do a job when they're scared to death that it's an unrealistic expectation and therefore they're going to fail and then they're going to be executed? I mean,
this is why I believe that over the longer term, North Korea and Kim Jong-un is facing a serious problem, because elite support is one of the most important pillars of regime stability, right? Because his father and his grandfather were able to go on and maintain the regime because the elites supported them. So it didn't matter that, in the mid-1990s, millions of people have died of famine and the public, whatever happens to the public, as long as the elites support the regime. And usually the North Korean elites have vested interests in keeping the status quo and keeping the system going because their fate is tied to the regime. But if I'm a North Korean elite right now, I would be seriously thinking about exit out, right? Because I would be thinking about, wow, if this guy can just execute his uncle, anybody who just dared to disagree with him, no one is safe. So I think Kim Jong-un is making a mistake here, because in order to control the elites, you have to also make them feel safe. But that's not what he's doing right now, and I think this will eventually backfire. Right now, all the elites are sort of lowering their heads and sort of like staying put, and because I would be scared to death of this guy, because you don't know if you're the next person to go. But over the longer term, I would be really planning about either defection or another plan. So I don't think this is good news, and this is not the right way to handle the elites. So I think he's making a mistake.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.